I got interested in transcendentalism, American transcendentalism, because it's a subject that stands at the nexus of a variety of fields like philosophy, literature, the environment, environmental history and perception, and also social history, to put it in a nutshell. So I entitled the lecture American Transcendentalism Texts, Context, and Legacy. So in your handout, in the handout which was given to you at the entrance of the hall, you have a number of texts which might be important if you want to understand what transcendentalism is about. Those are founding texts. So I'm going to commend some of these texts, parts of these texts, but I'll let you read the whole thing at home in the comfort of your own flat or at home anyway. So I'm going to develop 3 points today. First, I'm going to give you a definition, a formal definition of what transcendentalism is in the United States. I'll be telling you about the core beliefs that the transcendentalists convey, believe in, the influences of the movement, the past of the movement, where it comes from, and also I'll be telling you about the major figures of the movement, the famous transcendentalists. So I'll start with this, then I'll move on to the subject of education, because the legacy of the transcendentalists is partly in the field of education. They had a huge influence on the development of education, college education in the United States and also in England. And then I'll be telling you finally about nature, the conception of nature by the transcendentalists. Again, they have a major legacy there. They influenced the early ecological movements in the United States and led indirectly to the creation of the national parks in the United States. So starting with the origins and the core beliefs of transcendentalism, the movement developed as a reaction in the United States in the first half of the 19th century, as a reaction to prevalent intellectual theories about spirituality. Some of the transcendentalists, the early ones, were ministers of the church. So a reaction to theories about spirituality, religious institution, reaction about the way social life was working, organizing in New England, in the United States, in the early 19th century, reaction to policies of education, and also reaction to a rather utilitarian perception of the environment. Basically, in the early 19th century, and I'll come back to that later, the environment is seen as just a resource, a supply that is to be used, exploited by the pioneers and those who settled the land. So, to start with the church, the traditional view of the church was a very pessimistic one as far as man was concerned, as far as the corruption of man was concerned. The church, the ministry of the church, the preachers in Emerson's time in the early 19th century, strongly believed that man was originally corrupted, that he was born of corruption. It's not something new at the time, it's an idea which is inherited from the early Anglican preachers of the 16th century in England. In the 16th century in England, I'm just going back in time a little to explain this, you have the famous preacher, Godfrey Goodman, who writes that the human matrix, the womb of the woman, is, I put, a dungeon of darkness, a place of corruption, and that when a baby is born, he's born out of this dungeon of corruption, he says, wallowing in his own blood and excrement. So there's a very pessimistic view of the birth of man as the mark of original corruption. The transcendentalists disagree with this. They consider that man is inherently good and that it's only society which corrupts him. So they believe that man is born as good, and that he's corrupted not by social interactions with other men, but by social institutions, in particular the church, for some transcendentalists, and also politics and the organization of society, societal facts. So, according to the transcendentalists, according to Emerson, for one, to avoid such corruption, men have to achieve a degree of self-reliance. They have to be able to count only on themselves, to make experiences of self-reliance. So they have to move away from society, to observe the example of nature, to live alone or in the simple company of a few friends, and then return to society as better men or uncorrupted men. So this is an example of a reaction to traditional views of the church. In a way, this movement that emerges in the early 19th century in the United States is a modern movement. You talk about modernism in England in the 18th century, but you can also talk about modernism in a way for the transcendentalists. You have four ancient knowledge or traditional knowledge, the same skepticism that the early moderns had in England in the 18th century. I don't know if some of you are familiar with Jonathan Swift and an essay of his, which is entitled A Battle of the Books, which was written in the very early 18th century. And The Battle of the Books is a short satire, and Swift tells us about an imaginary battle in the library in which the books are fighting each other. You have books of ancient writings, writings from ancient Greece and Rome, and modern books, new forms written by modern writers, and they're fighting together. The modern books are arguing that you can't endlessly replicate or imitate the models of the past, and the ancients, the books from ancient Greece and Rome, pretend that they are superior and that they have to be acknowledged and imitated. And the result of that battle is not clear, and the conclusion of Swift is that you can't ignore the knowledge from the past, you have to acknowledge the classics, but you can't simply imitate them, you have to emulate and create new forms. And this is what is happening also in the beginning of the 19th century in the United States. So let's have a brief look at influences now of the movement. The movement was influenced first by European Romanticism. Most people see transcendentalism just as a sort of continuation of Romanticism, because you have in most transcendentalist writings this notion of isolation, of contemplation of nature, although a bit different, but I'll come back to the differences later. So it's influenced by Romanticism, by the writings of Wordsworth, of Coleridge. In terms of philosophy, it's also influenced by the skepticism of Hume, the 18th century Scottish philosopher, the fact that you have to doubt what Hume calls objective knowledge, that you have to question objective knowledge and confront it to new theories derived from observation and also derived from intuition. So there should be no accepted knowledge. You have to be skeptic when dealing with past elements of knowledge, objective knowledge. And it's also influenced by Kant, so a German philosopher of the 18th century, and the notion of transcendence, which is questioning the way to produce, again, objective knowledge out of intuition and out of observation. So how can you create objective knowledge? Is it through intuition? Is it through observation of nature? So the term transcendence actually comes from Kant, so from German philosophy. Actually, the transcendentalists did not choose that term. It's a term that was applied to the transcendentalists in their works by critics and by journalists, but they adopted it quite readily. And so this notion of transcendence is important, but there is no direct influence of Kant over the philosophy of Emerson. It is widely believed that the transcendentalists knew about Kant's philosophy through the British Romantics, who themselves had read Kant, including Coleridge. So now as to the major figures of the movement, it's not a very coherent movement. You have here a list of figures. Those you obviously know are Emerson and Thoreau. The others did not leave such an important trace in history, in the history of literature or civilization. You have a variety of profiles among those figures. You have ministers of the church, like Hedge or Putnam. You have philosophers, obviously. You have journalists, poets, educators. So they come from a variety of fields. And they actually are going to form a club, a society, in the 1830s. They're going to meet as the Transcendental Club between 1836 and 1840. So it's quite short a period, but after that, after 1840, they stop actually meeting, but they continue attending each other's lectures and corresponding as well. So I told you they were not very coherent. It was actually said about this Transcendental Club that the only thing they would agree on was the food and the drink they were going to have at their meetings, and nothing else, or not much else. Actually, you have no manifesto of Transcendentalism. There's no unique text that defines the spirit of the movement. The founding text, what is considered as the founding text, is Emerson's essays. Generally, they are considered, especially his essay on nature, they're considered as a sort of manifesto of Transcendentalism. So basically, the two figures that you have to remember are Emerson and Thoreau. I'm going to concentrate on those two for the rest of the lecture. So let's now come to education, and it seemed to be important to deal with education because the Transcendentalist conception of education and nature left a very important legacy, as I said, in the United States. So, starting with Emerson, who wrote an essay on education, you have important parts of this essay, or a long quote from this essay on your handout. Emerson believed in a very pragmatic approach of education that went well beyond school to encompass the observation of nature and also the transmission of skills. That was very important to Emerson. Education was to be a form of apprenticeship. You had to obviously follow models, existing models, get inspiration or examples from masters, and then develop your own skills. He considered, again Emerson, he considered as absurd the traditional vision of education according to which pupils and students have to imitate their masters and eventually become like them. According to Emerson, again, imitation cannot lead to progress. You cannot just imitate endlessly the ancients or existing models or existing knowledge. Each child or young adult must learn according to his needs and also according to his aspirations. That is, you don't teach someone who wants to become, let's say, an economist the same way as you teach someone who wants to become a journalist or a writer. So, this is a quote from the text you have, the essay on education. Emerson writes, I quote, about students, about young people, about a prototypical young man, if he be dexterous, his tuition should make it appear. If he be capable of dividing men with the trenchant sword of his thought, education should unsheathe and sharpen it. If he is one to cement society by his all reconciling affinities, oh, hasten their action. So students should be encouraged to read, according to Emerson, to read quite extensively, actually, to read poetry. Poetry has a very important place in education for the Transcendentalists. I'll come back to that later. They have to read the classics in order to broaden their minds and then to create, to emulate their own particular thought or mind. You may believe it or not, but yesterday, as I was preparing this lecture, I opened a papillote révision, and there was a quote by Emerson in my papillote, and I'm going to read it to you, obviously not the Révillon translation, but the original one. It was actually a quote on education, and the Papillote read, "Do not go where the path may lead, go instead where there is no path and leave a trail." So this is Emerson's advice to students. Go not where the path may lead, so do not follow the example of teachers or masters or guides. Go instead where there is no path and leave a trail. This does not mean that a student does not need teachers, but according to Emerson, the role, the function of a teacher should be limited to that of a guide to each student on the way to a particular vocation or inspiration. This means that, according to Emerson, a professor lecturing 1 or 200 students at a time, regardless of their individual talents or aspiration, should not be regarded as an adequate form of education. He is against lectures. He rather encourages seminars. You probably know what a seminar is in the Anglo-American education system, so small groups of students which gather to discuss a subject of a book or a book with their teacher, with the guidance of the master. So Emerson says that conversation between the students should also be encouraged. And actually, according to him, the only virtue of the American universities, the prestigious universities like Harvard, is that they bring students together and thus create a positive emulation, a sort of community that creates emulation for the students. And Emerson actually believed that if you took Harvard, if you took all the students from Harvard and their teachers, and if you just had them standing in an open field and asked them to talk together, it would come to a better result than the actual system of lectures that the students had to undergo at Harvard, or had to undergo at this time. So basically, this is what is happening right now with me and you. I have no particular regard for what are your aspirations, so some of you are going to derive useful things for this lecture, but for many of you it's going to be completely useless, or at least partly, I hope, useless. So let's have another quote on education, still from the same essay, about the traditional education, about the institutions of education in the early 19th century. He wrote, I quote, "It is ominous, a presumption of crime, that this word education has so called so hopeless a sound. A treatise on education, a convention for education, a lecture, a system, affects us with slight paralysis and a certain yawning of the jaws." So basically he means that most educational theories and educational practices are boring and lead to paralysis of the mind. And he goes on writing, I quote again from the same essay, "I suffer whenever I see the common sight of a parent or senior imposing his opinion and way of thinking and being on a young soul to which they are totally unfit. Cannot we let people be themselves and enjoy life in their own way?" And here he is addressing teachers, says, "You are trying to make that man another you, one is enough." So teachers are trying to reproduce, to replicate their own model, and they should not do that. They should take into account the aspiration of students and also new forms and a new society which is emerging in the United States at the time. So basically he criticizes traditional forms of education as a form of social reproduction or replication of elites. In Emerson's view again, scholarly education should resemble apprenticeship. Just as a craftsman or an artist or a tradesman can gain wisdom and skill from observing other people of his trade or of his art, the scholar is going to benefit from interactions with others, but also, now coming to nature, also from interactions with nature and the observation of nature. Observing nature, being in communion with nature is also part of education according to the transcendentalists. According to Emerson, actually, and this is my next quote, still on the essay on education, he writes, I quote, "Is it not true that every landscape I behold, every friend I meet, every act I perform, every pain I suffer, leaves me a different being from that they found me? So every experience of life, and including every landscape I behold, is changing me. So in a way, it is educating me." According to Emerson, it's only thanks to experiences of self-reliance and communion with nature, isolation and communion with nature, that man, as I was saying earlier, can eventually become virtuous and return as a virtuous member of the community, can get rid, can shed the corruption which is inherent not to man's nature, but to man's culture and society. So I'm coming to nature now, and first I'm going to be dealing with the influence of the British Romantics on Transcendentalism. This American Transcendentalism is similar to British Romanticism in many ways, including the fact that it advocates isolation from modern society. This is something which is not new in the time of Emerson. It comes from the English Romanticism of the 18th century. The contemplation of nature should lead, according to the Romantics and to the Transcendentalists, the contemplation of nature should lead to a broader understanding of the cosmos, generally speaking, and also, and this is specific to the Transcendentalists, also to a communion with the divine, to spirituality. In Transcendentalist writings, landscapes, plants, animals seem inhabited with a spiritual presence. In some of the texts of the Transcendentalists, this presence, this numinous spiritual presence, is just spiritual. In some others, it's really actually related to God, to the God of the Christians. So this point of view is expressed in one of the texts I gave you. It's text number 4 in your handout, in a text by Thoreau, an extract from Walden. Maybe some of you are familiar with Thoreau. Thoreau is a student of Emerson, and he actually practiced this philosophy of transcendentalism and self-reliance by moving away from his hometown of Concord and building a log cabin, a small cabin near a pond in the forest, a pond which was called Walden Pond. And he wrote a book on this experiment of self-reliance that year, during which he was living alone by the side of a pond. And this is what he writes. So this is the passage you have in your handout. I'm going to project it as well. "I have spent the hours of midnight fishing from a boat by moonlight, serenaded by owls and foxes, and hearing from time to time the creaking notes of some unknown bird close at hand. These experiences were very, very memorable and valuable to me. Anchored in 40 feet of water and 20 or 30 rods from the shore, surrounded sometimes by thousands of small perch and shiners, dimpling the surface with their tails in the moonlight, and communicating by a long flaxen line with mysterious nocturnal fishes, which had their dwelling 40 feet below, or sometimes dragging 60 feet of line about the pond as I drifted in the gentle night breeze, now and then feeling a slight vibration along it, indicative of some life crawling about its extremity. A dull, uncertain, blundering purpose there, and slow to make up his mind. At length you slow your eyes, pulling hand over hand, some horned cow squeaking and squirming to the upper air. It was very queer, especially in dark nights, When your thoughts had wandered to vast and cosmogonal themes in other spheres, to feel this faint jerk which came to interrupt your dreams and link you to nature again. It seemed as if I might next cast my line upwards in the air, as well as downwards into this element, which was scarcely more dense. Thus I caught two fishes, as it were, with one hook. So here you have a number of interesting points. You have things that you can relate to Romanticism. First, very clearly an anthropocentric vision of nature, of the landscape described. Thoreau stands right in the middle of the pond, right in the middle of the forest, and everything seems to be centered or articulated around him, around his presence. Nature seems, in a way, or on a first level of understanding, to serve him. You have the animals that serenade him, that sing to him, to please him. You have those perch and shiners that swim around his boat and that dimple the surface as if it were to please him again. So a very anthropocentric vision of nature and the appreciation of nature. But then if you read a bit more carefully, if you go beyond that surface, you also have elements of nature which have another function, which are not actually linked to this pleasure that the poet, Thoreau as a poet or as a writer, derives from the contemplation of nature. You have, for example, this fish that is much deeper in the pond and that touches his line as if to call him back from his meditations, and that seems to have an uncertain blundering purpose. The fish has a purpose. And this is very important. Nature is not just here to please Thoreau. It has a purpose of its own. And this is something which is actually introduced by the transcendentalists over that layer of simple contemplation, pleasant contemplation that you have in the British Romantics. So you have a spirituality in nature. Nature has an intrinsic value, has a purpose of its own, not regarding what man wants to do of it or how they want to enjoy it. And obviously, if you still consider this mysterious fish, you could relate it to a Christ-like figure. Very often in sacred texts, fish is a symbol of Christ, like in the book of Tobit in the Bible, for instance. And so when he says that he catches two fishes, as it were, with one hook, it could mean that he is both in touch with nature and also in touch with God in that experience of transcendence. Do you find similar ideas in Emerson, in his essay on nature? The next quote is, again, from the longer excerpt I gave you in your handout. So this is from Emerson's essay on nature. I quote, he writes, "The stems of pines," so he writes that about a forest. "The stems of pines, hemlocks, and oaks almost gleam like iron on the excited eye. The incommunicable trees begin to persuade us to live with them and quit our life of solemn trifles. Here, no history or church or state is interpolated on the divine sky and the immortal year. How easily we might walk onward into opening landscape, absorbed by new pictures and by thoughts fast succeeding each other, until by degrees the recollection of home was crowded out of the mind, all memory obliterated by the tyranny of the present, and we are led in triumph by nature." So again, you have this conception of nature as being a support to man, as being there for the enjoyment of man. But then it has another function, the communication of nature with nature. The isolation in nature obliterates Well, here Emerson talks about the history, the church, and the state. So it obliterates all those artificial conventions of man's society, which creates that corruption according to the transcendentalists. So now let's have a look at the role of the transcendentalist as a writer, because the transcendentalist writings have clearly a didactic value for their authors, for Emerson, for Thoreau, and the others. In Nature, the essay, Emerson describes the transcendentalist poet or writer as a transparent idol. And this is a very important concept when dealing with transcendentalism, the one of the transparent idol, suggesting that his role, Emerson's role as a poet or as a writer, is to share his knowledge and wisdom by pointing the reader's gaze towards objects of contemplation, as if they were parables from which we have, as readers, to derive a certain meaning. So again, this is very close to the Romantics, who describe their own emulation or their own transcendence in front of natural prospects, in front of the awe-inspiring spectacle of nature. But here you have something more, another degree, and I quote this passage from Emerson again. He writes, "In the woods we return to reason and faith. There I feel nothing that can befall me in life, no disgrace, no calamity living in my eyes, which nature cannot repair. Standing on the bare ground, my head bathed by the blithe air, and uplifted into infinite space, all mean egotism vanishes. I become a transparent eyeball. I am nothing, I see all. The currents of the universal being circulate through me. I am part and particle of God." So this is an attempt at a definition of what should be a transcendental experience in nature, in isolation in nature. And this notion of the transparent eyeball, which is introduced here, is very much used in literary criticism when dealing with the transcendentalists and with the stance of the transcendentalist poets and writers. It suggests that a text is supposed to assume a didactic function. It becomes a sort of prism through which we as readers are oriented or guided towards an understanding, a sort of revelation through a description of a natural prospect, a natural landscape. So there is a relation between education and poetry, between education and writing in the transcendentalist works. Emerson writes, still about poetry, sorry. Where's that quote? Oh, it's not here. Anyway, he writes, "Why always coast on the surface and never open the interior of nature, not by science, which is surface still, but by poetry?" So he suggests that education, of course, can be achieved by science, by objective knowledge, but also can be achieved on a deep level through poetry. So I gave you, again in the handout, two examples of poems, one by Emerson, the Rhodora, the first one, text 6, and a very famous romantic poem by Wordsworth, The Daffodils. So I'd like to compare those two poems. So let's start. Probably some of you have read already The Daffodils by Wordsworth. It's a very famous romantic poem in which Wordsworth remembers a day during which he came across a field of daffodils which were dancing in the breeze, and he derived great delight from that vision, and he derived great delight from the memory of that vision later when he thought about it again. So let's start with Emerson's poem, then I'll come back on Wordsworth, or to Wordsworth. So it's a poem, it's It's not a very well-known poem. The transcendentalists are not really acknowledged for their poetic talents, which is a pity according to me. This is a poem which was written in 1847, entitled The Rhodora. The Rhodora is a flower. And Emerson gives us a context to that poem. He writes, as a sort of preface, on being asked, whence is the flower? And this is the poem. In May, when sea winds pierced our solitudes, I found the fresh rhodora in the woods, spreading its leafless blooms in a damp nook to please the desert and the sluggish brook. The purple petals falling in the pool made the black water with their beauty gay. Here might the red bird calm his plumes to cool, and call the flower that cheapens his array. Rhodora, if the sages ask thee why this charm is wasted on the earth and sky, tell them, dear, that if eyes were made for seeing, then beauty is its own excuse for being. Why thou wert there, O rival of the rose, I never thought to ask, I never knew. But in my simple ignorance suppose, the self-same power that brought me there brought you. So, here you have again this notion that we observed in Thoreau's text of an intrinsic value of nature. This beautiful flower is here that he comes across by accident. He's here in a sort of dark place, in a damp nook, and he sees it spreading its bloom, and he reflects on the purpose of this flower. Why is it here if no man is ever going to see it? If it's not intended for man's enjoyment, why is this beauty existing if it's not for man to behold? And the answer is that the self-same power that brought me there brought you. That nature has the same status as men in divine creation. That nature has an intrinsic value, that it's not planted there by God just for man's enjoyment. So this is where the poem differs with the British Romantics. It's probably a poem that has an intertextual reference to Wordsworth's daffodils, because you have the notion of a flower that makes the poet gay. It's the same word which is used by Wordsworth in this very famous poem on the right, the daffodils, which I'm going to read now. You probably know this one. It's much earlier, it's 1805. I wandered lonely as a cloud that floats on high over vales and hills, when all at once I saw a crowd, a host of golden daffodils. Beside the lake, beneath the trees, fluttering and dancing in the breeze, continuous as the stars that shine and twinkle on the Milky Way, they stretched in never-ending line along the margin of a bay. 10,000 saw I at a glance, tossing their heads in sprightly dance. The waves beside them danced, but they outdid the sparkling waves in glee. A poet could not but be gay in such a jocund company. I gazed and gazed, but little thought what wealth their show to me had brought. For oft, when on my couch I lie, in vacant or in pensive mood, they flash upon the inward eye, which is the bliss of solitude. And then my heart with pleasure fills and dances with the daffodils. So here you have this notion, again you have the notion of pleasure, of positive pleasure derived from the contemplation of nature, of beauty in nature, but also from the reminding of this experience, this experiment of contemplation. So you have the same thing in Emerson, obviously. But what's interesting here, and that I wanted to underline in the poem by Wordsworth, is the notion of an inward eye of the poet. The poet has an inward eye through which he can conjure up images from the past, from past contemplations, bring them back to his mind, and experience again the joy of contemplation. And this is also the function of poetry according to the Romantics. It's to share that contemplation of beauty and that pleasure that one feels in front of a beautiful prospect, especially a natural prospect. So if you go back to Emerson and to the Rhodora and to this notion of an intrinsic value of nature, of the beauty in nature, this notion of intrinsic value and significance of nature stands in contrast with the traditional Protestant utilitarian vision of nature as a sort, as I said earlier, of resources or supply for humanity's expansion. And this traditional vision is connected, as you probably know, with the notion of manifest destiny. I think you studied it, some of you, in class with your teacher, Florian Bouzon. So, according to the notion of manifest destiny, the land is meant for those who are willing to settle it, to cultivate it, to exploit it. And this traditional vision is illustrated by a painting which I think some of you have studied as well, American Progress by John Garst. So here's the painting. So it's rather late, it's 1872, so it's well after the essays of Emerson. It represents really a very traditional perception of nature that fits into the pattern of manifest destiny. You have first in the painting a distinction between light and darkness. You have this allegory of progress which seems to radiate, to create light around her, which represents civilizations, the pioneers, which are seen, considered as harbingers of civilizations. And away from that figure of progress that represents American pioneers, everything is dark, everything is plunged in darkness. It's as if nature were waiting to be enlightened and changed by men, by white men obviously. Indians here are not considered as men by the artist. Then you have the notion of the shaping of the landscape and the fact that a natural landscape is turning into a cultural landscape, a landscape which is fashioned by the presence of man. You have the railroads, the trains and tracks on the image. You've got the telegraph, the allegory of progress actually carrying a bundle of wire. And you have agriculture as well, the exploitation of land. And then finally, you have the idea that nature is waiting to be transformed and exploited. Again, this is related to the notion of manifest destiny. Using nature means civilizing. Civilizing means having a natural right to the land. So nature and those who are living on it are insignificant in the eyes of God and men before those pioneers actually cast an eye on them and used them. So obviously this is very far from the transcendentalist conception of nature that we've just been studying. And the transcendentalist conception of nature, in turn, is related to the first ecological movements that are going to appear in the United States in the second half of the 19th century, and that are going to lead to the creation of the national parks in the United States. The last text I gave you on the handouts is a text by John Muir. John Muir is a naturalist. He was active during the last decades of the 19th century. And his activism led to the creation of Yosemite National Park and also the Sequoia National Park. And this man, John Muir, was very much influenced by Emerson. He was not a student of Emerson. He met Emerson rather late, actually. He met Emerson in the flesh in 1871. It was near the place that would later become the Sequoia National Park, so an untouched grove of giant sequoias that were going to be about to be protected. And Emerson came there to give a lecture in a town nearby, and John Muir attended the lecture, and after the lecture he went and met Emerson, and he offered Emerson to spend the night camping under the sequoias, and Emerson refused, and he preferred staying at his comfortable hotel, John Muir was very much disappointed at that point. But anyway, he was emulated by Emerson's vision of nature as expressed in his essays. So here is a short text by John Muir, a short extract from a very influential book that was published in 1894 called The Mountains of California, which is basically a description. It's not a literary text, it's a description of the Sierra Nevada, mostly, by John Muir. John Muir walked a lot through the Sierra Nevada, and he described those landscapes and the beauty of those landscapes and tried to have the notion of preservation emerge in the United States at the time. He tried to explain why those landscapes deserved to be protected from that those transformations that civilization implies. So he wrote, I quote, again, it's a short passage from the longer text I gave you. No great valley, so it's about the Sierra Nevada. No great valley or lake is seen, or river, or group of well-marked features of any kind, standing out in distinct pictures. Even the summit peaks, so clear and high in the sky, seem comparatively smooth and featureless. Nevertheless, glaciers are at work in the shadows of the peaks, and thousands of lakes and meadows shine and bloom beneath them, and the whole range is furrowed with canyons to a depth of from 2,000 to 5,000 feet, in which once flowed majestic glaciers, and in which now flows and sing a band of beautiful rivers. So, if you compare that to the texts by Emerson and Thoreau, you realize that this is very different, a rather different approach. First, you have the notion of geological time, which appears in the writings of Muir, which was quite absent from the writings of Emerson and the early transcendentalists. Geological time and the history of human presence are on a completely different scale. Here, you have the mention of the glaciers shaping the landscape, well before, obviously, white men arrived in the United States or in America, on the American continent, even before the Indians started spreading on the land. So basically, again, you have this idea that nature didn't wait for us to be transformed. It has a sort of agenda of its own, a time of its own, a geological time. And this geological time, in Muir's work, it's not very clear in this passage, but you're going to see that in the longer excerpt I gave you. This geological time is related to religiosity. The rocks are compared to sculptures, sometimes to churches, and these considerations suggest that human achievements are insignificant when compared to nature as God's creation. So you have to preserve nature as intact, in order, as a reminder of the superiority and the glory of God's creation. The word glory, glorious, is repeated, I think, five times in the excerpts I gave you to describe nature, to describe those mountains of California. Another point is that there are rivers and meadows in that text, and lakes that are hidden or inaccessible to men, so not intended for men's enjoyment, a bit like Emerson's Rhodora, the flower that just blooms in the darkness, deep into the woods, away from man's gaze. So again, you have this idea, this time inherited from Emerson, that nature is not waiting for man to be enjoyed, that nature has its own purpose, that nature has its own reason for being, similarly to man. And then, if you again compare this text to Thoreau and Emerson, to the writings we saw before, here you have a much less anthropocentric vision. You're going to see this very clearly when you read the whole page I gave you. You have a certain distanciation between Muir as an observer and nature, and what he is the object of his description. There's no real communication or communion. There's just inspiration, and also the intuition of something which is designed by God and that must be respected as a symbol of the glory of creation. Again, the term glory is repeated again and again in that text. So, as a conclusion to those remarks on transcendentalism, really the transcendentalists had a major contribution to the evolution, they were a major contribution to the evolution of the Anglo-American educational system, but also a major contribution to ecology as a science and as an emerging science, obviously, in the 19th century. Ecology being, obviously, the way we relate to our environment, the way we are coherent with what surrounds us. And so with the transcendentalists, there's a new idea that emerges, the fact that nature, which has always been exploited just simply as a resource by American people in the context of that notion of the manifest destiny, this new idea that nature should be respected and maybe even protected, which is, in the early 19th century, a very unusual thought. I just wanted to tell you again, as a conclusion, about Stanley Cavell, who is a major American philosopher. Maybe you've read about Stanley Cavell or pieces by Stanley Cavell. He wrote a lot about the cinema. He was the one who theorized cinema as a field of studies. And he came to Lyon a few years ago to receive a doctorat honoris causa from the ENS de Lyon. And he gave a really nice speech. And he talked about Emerson and the transcendentalists, saying that their legacy is very much, their intellectual legacy is very much neglected in the United States. You have very few scholars, compared to Europe or even to France, you have very few scholars in the United States that are really interested in Emerson and that teach Emerson in studies. And Stanley Cavell said that this was obviously regrettable. And maybe you could guess that the reasons for this neglect is actually the contrast or even the contradiction between the transcendentalist thought about nature and that notion of manifest destiny. And there is, in a way, transcendentalism presents us with an historical contradiction in a nation which was actually built on the utilitarian vision of nature based on the idea of manifest destiny. Thank you. That would be all.